The headlines. Iran says it is suspicious about Sunday's rocket attack on the U.S. embassy in Iraq, warning Washington against instigating tensions. Countries around the world ban flights to and from Britain over a fast-spreading new strain of the new coronavirus. Also coming up, Indian farmer leaders step up pressure on Prime Minister Narendra Modi to repeal his agricultural reform laws by starting a 24-hour relay hunger strike. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has warned the U.S. not to seek tension and conflict with Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh was responding to a tweet by the U.S. Foreign Secretary, which he accused Iran-backed groups of being behind a recent rocket attack on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. Khatibzadeh said that Iran has always condemned any attack on diplomatic buildings. He said the timing of the recent attack and Mike Pompeo's statement were suspicious, as if he had prepared the statement before the rocket strike. Khatibzadeh said that Pompeo is known to the world as a liar. Political commentator Mohammad Obaid says the latest attack on Baghdad's grain zone shows some smaller factions are trying to create a warlike scenario.
It seems that there are some minor players who are trying to play, and they are not professional. They have not been able to achieve any goals. Probably you have to take into account all the time the Israeli factor, the other regional powers or countries that are have been seeking for a long time now to have an American-Iranian conflict, and they've been seeking to do so. So we have to keep in mind all these players, all these elements, in order to try to come out with a conclusion that it is not something that was adopted and that was not the responsibility was not claimed by any major power, by any major country. So the only remaining factor is that you have these powers that are seeking to have more tension in the region and hoping to see an American-Iranian conflict. In this regard,
the remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal have once again called for preserving the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The call was made in a statement following a virtual meeting attended by foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany. They said the agreement is a significant achievement of multilateral diplomacy that contributes to regional and international security. The ministers reiterated their deep regret over the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the pact. They said that U.N. Security Council Resolution 22-31 that endorsed the deal remains fully in force. Britain says significant differences remain in negotiations with the European Union as the deadline for a post-Brexit deal draws closer. A spokesman for the UK Prime Minister said that London will not seek any extension to the transition period. He said that Britain would need to ratify any agreement by January 1st, when it will leave the EU Single Market and Customs Union. The official, however, noted that London will continue to try to bridge the remaining gaps. A number of European countries have called on Johnson to extend the post-Brexit transition period, citing concerns over a new COVID-19 strain in Britain. London and Brussels are at odds over a number of key issues, particularly the EU's fishing rights in British waters and a level playing field. Britain says it is in contact with its allies to minimize transport disruption amid suspension of travel to and from the UK over coronavirus fears. The spokesman for Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that he is coordinating with France to open the key border between the two neighbors. Fears are growing that some foodstuff, mainly imported from France, could run out in as little as 2 weeks. The border closures are triggered by reports of a fast-spreading new strain of COVID-19. The variant occurred in London and southeast England, where major restrictions were already in place to curb the surge in infections. Travel and freight bans have been introduced by dozens of countries as wide apart as Canada, India, and many European nations. The German government source said a flight ban could be adopted by all 27 members of the EU. From London, Robert Inlacash says the facts surrounding the new strain of the COVID-19 in the UK are still unknown, and there are doubts if vaccination can stop it.
What we currently do not know are the facts surrounding the new coronavirus strain. So, for instance, we don't know if there are new symptoms as a result of it yet. We don't have any data, any evidence to suggest that it makes you more sick. We don't yet know as well whether the vaccinations will be enough to stop this as well. And so that's been the talk here in this country. We don't yet know much at all about this new strain of COVID-19. And people have been speculating that the European move to close the borders off completely could have something to do with Brexit talks. It could be politicized. Whilst others have said that no, countries like Kuwait and Morocco have announced that they've also shut down travel. So at the moment, people in the UK are feeling pretty down. They're not going to get to celebrate Christmas with their loved ones. But at the same time, people are concerned because of the fact that they aren't really in the know at the moment about this new coronavirus strain.
Europe keeps struggling with a second wave of COVID-19, with daily cases remaining high in several countries. Germany registered over 16,000 new cases, raising its total tally to over 1.5 million. German authorities also reported 226 new coronavirus-related fatalities in 24 hours. In Russia, health officials registered a record increase in infections, reporting over 29,000 new cases, with over 490 deaths. In Switzerland, official data shows that coronavirus infections rose by over 10,000 since Friday. The total number of confirmed cases in Switzerland and neighboring Liechtenstein has increased to nearly 414,000. Swiss authorities will tighten restrictions on Tuesday to curb the spread of the disease. Meanwhile, France plans to begin vaccination against COVID-19 from December 27.
La France?
Like its European counterparts, France will start vaccinating at the end of next weekend. In 1 week, next Monday, we will have started vaccinating. It will be a gradual start, as you would expect.
According to Varin, France will start its vaccination campaign with the most vulnerable members of the population. Earlier this week, a number of European countries, including Spain and Italy, also announced plans to begin vaccinations against the novel coronavirus by the end of the month. This is European Medicines Regulator, that is, on Monday, authorized the COVID-19 vaccine, jointly developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. Indian farmers have stepped up pressure on the government to withdraw its agricultural reforms by starting a 24-hour relay hunger strike. According to farmer leaders, protesters will participate in the hunger strike in batches, with the first holding 11 members. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government has urged demonstrators to take part in further talks. This comes after many rounds of talks with the farmers' union ended inconclusively. Thousands of farmers, mainly from the state of Punjab and Haryana, have been protesting against the new laws for over 4 weeks. Modi has repeatedly defended the legislation, saying that it would help increase farmers' income by encouraging more private investment. Russia and China have both rejected accusations of involvement in a recent cyber attack that hit government agencies in the U.S. China said the tweets by President Donald Trump suggesting Beijing's involvement were a farce made for political motives. Russia has likewise denied any role in the attacks, saying that there is an absence of evidence in the accusations. On Friday, the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that it was the Russians that engaged in this activity. However, President Donald Trump cast doubt on Russia's role in two tweets on Saturday, hinting instead at China's involvement. Experts say that the cyber attacks have not only struck U.S. government agencies, including the Treasury Department, but also hit targets worldwide, with the list of victims still emerging. Jason Anruha is a political commentator joining us. So what is very interesting here is, on the one hand, you do have a very large cyber attack that has taken place. So you have, on the one hand, that issue. Then you have the fact that the U.S. Was penetrated. So it shows U.S.'s vulnerability. And, of course, then the other branch to this is the fact that the U.S. is coming out without evidence, accusing Russia, which Trump didn't particularly stand behind Pompeo's accusations against Russia on that, but also China.
Well, I think it's very questionable, the whole situation, when the U.S. government can't even decide who it was that allegedly attacked them. If you've got portions saying it was Russia and portions saying it was China, I mean, it's pretty obvious from IP addresses where particular attacks might have been coming from. But the fact that they can't even determine who it was that actually attacked them is certainly suspicious enough as it is. As we do recall, it was the last election, the election in which Donald Trump was initially elected, that it was claimed that Russia carried out a hacking attack against the Democratic Party. Of course, this was upon investigation proven to be a lie, considering that the data transfer rate of the emails taken from Democratic servers could not have been done over the internet, but in fact were taken by a flash drive connected directly to their computers there inside their actual offices. But this has been a long-running narrative for the past 4 years, claiming that Russia had interfered in these elections. And if that had been the case, you'd think that the intelligence community would have taken it a bit more seriously and not simply just kept insisting, but actually done something about it. So I'm very skeptical of this claim. The problem with hacking attacks is that you can tell the public anything, and you don't have to provide a shred of evidence for anything that's being claimed. That's the very nature of cyber attacks in general. They're incredibly vague. But we have a question of who has credibility in this situation. And frankly, the U.S. government, given everything that it has done, not just in the past 4 years, but in the past many decades, it doesn't have much credibility at all. This has been a long-standing thing now to make accusations of hacking. Previously, even before this, it was claimed that the DPRK hacked Sony and did some damage to their infrastructure for a movie that was insulting the country.
Thank you very much for that. Jason Anuja, political commentator, talking to us there from Niagara Falls. Many thanks. Moving on, Beijing says it firmly opposes a U.S. bill that could remove Chinese firms from U.S. exchanges.
China firmly opposes this. The action from the U.S. is unreasonable political suppression on Chinese firms that are listed in the U.S.
Chinese foreign minister said the legislation will seriously hinder the normal listing of Chinese companies. He slammed the move for violating basic market economy rules that the U.S. has always promoted. Beijing urged the U.S. to stop making the mistake of politicizing security regulations. On Friday, the U.S. President Donald Trump signed a bill that could remove Chinese companies from U.S. stock exchanges unless they adhere to American auditing standards. Although the legislation applies to all foreign companies, Beijing says that it is aimed at Chinese firms. Beijing and Washington have been at loggerheads over a number of issues, including trade, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. In December 2012, Canada joined a number of Western countries in removing the name of the anti-Iran group MKO from its list of designated terror organizations. Ottawa did not provide any explanation why it made the decision about the group, whose terror operations have claimed thousands of lives. The MKO does not have mercy even on its own members. Defectors have reported widespread torture and forced sterilization at the group's camps.
Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 20, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Iran's army chief, Major General Mousavi, said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh last month. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision. Since removing its decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran.
The violence committed by the cult-like group is such that out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians who were killed in terrorist attacks since Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution, about 12,000 have fallen victim. The terrorist group is also known for its extremely suppressive control over members in its camps, where access, for example, to the internet and other information sources is prohibited. Amid the Trump administration's heightened rhetoric and its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran, the MKO has also sought to gain further support from Washington and its allies by expanding its operations against the Islamic Republic. But what is the end the West is looking for that justifies the means, even if it involves condoning heinous acts of terror?
In September 2012, then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said Washington was expunging the MKO from its list of designated terror organizations. The decision came after intense lobbying backed by prominent U.S. officials that included James Woolsey and Porter J. Goss, former CIA directors, Louis J. Free, the former FBI director, President George W. Bush's Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, and Attorney General Michael Mukasey, and President Obama's first National Security Advisor, General James Jones. Many of the U.S. officials had been paid between $15,000 to $30,000 to deliver speeches to the group, as well as travel expenses to attend lavish rallies in Paris. Former Governor of Pennsylvania, Edward Rendell, said in 2012 that he had been paid a total of $150,000 to $160,000. In 2016 and 2017, Saudi Arabia's former spy chief, Prince Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, attended MKO meetings in Paris. Advanced with God's blessings, bin Faisal said in a speech in the 2016 meeting, wishing the terrorists success in attempting, quote, regime change in Iran. In 2018, another meeting in Paris attracted Rudy Giuliani, personal attorney to U.S. President Donald Trump, and Stephen Harper, a former Prime Minister of Canada. Pulitzer Prize winner Seymour Hersh reported in 2012 that a number of MKO members were secretly trained by the United States Joint Special Operations Command at the Department of Energy's Nevada National Security Site, a secretive training facility northwest of Las Vegas. The report was followed by another revelation in 2018 that the terrorists were receiving funds through Saudi smuggling networks and Saudi-linked black market sales to continue their subversive agenda. But what does this say about MKO supporters, except that they have become so desperate in their subversive attempts in Iran that they have turned to a cult group they once blacklisted as a terror organization?
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As new coronavirus cases and deaths surge in the United States of America, the combined number of confirmed cases among people incarcerated in immigration jails and state and federal prisons has surpassed 250,000, according to federal data and the Marshall Project. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading, COVID cases in U.S. prisons and ICE immigration jails surpass 250,000. Here's the details. The United States has the world's highest incarceration rate and largest systems for locking people up. As soon as the COVID-19 pandemic began, experts and advocates warned the virus would be amplified by prisons and jails, where social distancing is impossible. Ventilation is often poor and people are more likely to have underserved medical needs. The virus, they warned, would spread quickly both inside and beyond prison walls. They were right. As new cases and deaths surge nationwide, the combined number of confirmed cases among people incarcerated in immigration jails and state and federal prisons has surpassed 250,000, according to federal data and the Marshall Project. The number of cases has more than quadrupled since July, and infection rates have steadily grown since September. During the week prior to December 8, 2,224 new cases were reported nationally, an increase of 10% from the week before. At least 1,665 incarcerated people have died due to the virus, although that may be an undercount because testing and reporting practices vary widely across various prison systems in the U.S. In the spring, activists demanded that local sheriffs, prison officials, and immigration jailers release as many people as possible, if not everyone, and implement clear pandemic protocols. But advocates say decision makers did not move fast enough. Instead, prison officials and local sheriffs downplayed or simply ignored the crisis, some of them wrongly believing their facilities would be immune from a virus impacting the entire globe. There were modest dips in incarceration rates during the initial month of the pandemic, in part because some wardens and sheriffs refused to take new prisoners or judges ordered the release of the medically vulnerable. However, the decarceration process has been slow and inconsistent across various prison systems, often prodded along by court orders, frustrated state governors, media scandals, and the sheer reality of the pandemic. Now, incarceration rates appear headed in the opposite direction, even as the pandemic reaches its most intense phase to date. Population drops at state prisons slowed or reversed over the summer, and the number of people held in local jails is the highest since April, according to the Prison Policy Initiative. Public health experts are pushing to prioritize prisoners as vaccines become available. But activists say we must rethink mass incarceration altogether. If incarceration stopped violence, the U.S. would be the safest country in the world, said Louis Webb, a healing justice coordinator for the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC. Instead, we have 2.3 million people in cages while our communities lack access to quality health care, education, employment, addiction, and mental health services, and an approach to justice that actually addresses the root causes of violence. More than 66,000 prison and immigration jail staff in the United States of America have tested positive, and at least 112 have died, according to reports and available data. These workers return home to their families every day, potentially bringing the virus with them. Prisons and jails topped the New York Times list of largest outbreaks in last summer and early fall. And research now shows that the virus has spread much faster in parts of the country where prisons and immigration jails are located. The Prison Policy Initiative estimates that mass incarceration added 500,000 COVID cases over the 3 months of summer as outbreaks behind bars spread into surrounding communities. People released from jail and prison often return to lower-income communities of color, which are disproportionately impacted by mass incarceration and the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the National Academies of Sciences. Between May and August, jails run by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and its contractors alone were responsible for about 245,000 cases across the U.S., according to a new report from the Detention Watch Network. The consequences of ICE's callous disregard for the health of people and detained and its own staff were magnified many times over by the uncontrolled spread of COVID-19 in communities across the U.S., said Gregory Hooks, co-author of the report in a statement. Counties with ICE facilities were more likely to experience outbreaks of COVID-19, both small and large, in the spring and over the summer. The impacts rippled outward, extending to nearby communities and counties. The number of people caged in ICE jails ballooned under Trump administration's harsh crackdown on immigration and set the stage for a COVID-19 crisis. In April, a federal judge in California ruled that ICE delayed its pandemic response with dangerous results and ordered the agency to review its decisions to incarcerate people at particular risk of COVID-19 complications due to health problems. In October, the judge issued a terse clarifying order after finding that ICE had fallen short, and its review of custody decisions was a disorganized patchwork of non-responses or perfunctory denials. Other courts also rebuked ICE and the private contractors that run many of its jails. In August, a federal judge ordered ICE to stop transferring people to an immigration prison in Farmville, Virginia, after the facility saw an outbreak of 339 cases, according to Detention Watch Network. In late October, a judge in California ordered an ICE prison in Southern California to reduce its population by 250 people to make room for social distancing. The list goes on. At least 1,909 people have been released from immigration jails under court orders, according to ICE. ICE now reports that 16,163 people are incarcerated in its jails across the U.S., down from an average daily population of over 50,000 before COVID hit in 2019. However, ICE reports that it has released only 900 people with medical conditions that put them at risk of COVID-19 complications after reviewing their immigration histories and criminal records. The population drop is likely driven by pandemic restrictions at the border, preventing asylum seekers and migrants from entering the country and being detained in the first place. Mora Vilal Pando, an organizer with La Resistencia, a group led by undocumented people that works to end the deportation and incarceration of immigration in Washington State, said the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma only recently began releasing immigrants under the court order from April. The immigration jail is run by GEO Group, a for-profit prison company whose revenue is shaped by the number of people incarcerated under a contract with ICE. They really didn't do anything until maybe now, Mora Villapanda said in an interview. ICE reports that one person has tested positive for COVID at the Northwest Detention Center, but Mora Villalpando says her group has reports of additional cases inside the facility. A man was recently put in medical isolation after suffering chills and a fever, but a report submitted under court orders due to ongoing litigation claimed the man was asymptomatic, according to La Resistencia. Mora Villalpando said this is another example of ICE attempting to cover for its inability to control the virus and why people still incarcerated at the jail fear for their lives. Now that ICE is finally releasing people from the Northwest Detention Center and other immigration jails across the country to make room for social distancing more than 6 months into the pandemic, Mora Villalpando said it goes to show that thousands of people were needlessly incarcerated under the Trump administration's border crackdown. The population at the Northwest Detention Center has dropped from more than 1,500 to 300 in recent weeks. The hunger strikers and La Resistencia are demanding that the remaining 300 people be released, starting with the most medically vulnerable. Activists across the United States of America are holding actions calling for release of prisoners during the pandemic and pushing new visions of public safety under the hashtag Free Them All.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Faith in Resurrection and Human Development. Faith in resurrection, besides logically interpreting and revolving the puzzle of life and death, and besides being a truth which must be accepted, produces diverse effects on human life, the most important of them being the following two. Number one, the picture of death, which had always been appalling and thought of which had always disturbed the peace of mind, has undergone a complete change. With the acknowledgement of resurrection and quote-unquote life after death, in a world where all the gifts of life will exist eternally, and on a higher and bigger scale, the picture of death is no longer as dreadful and appalling as it was, and the scenes of death and old age no longer disturb the peace of mind. The unrest and anxiety caused by the thought of death is not as painful to us as to the materialists, and thus we can lead a more comfortable and satisfied life. The believers in the life hereafter welcome sacrifice and martyrdom for a sacred cause, for they regard them as a prelude to a new life in a higher and wider world. So if you look at the state of mind of a materialist, you know, somebody who's immersed in materialism and whose worldview is that it's only matter that exists, okay? He's all about the material existence. He does not accept the metaphysical existence of beings. Consider the state of mind of such a person. What do you think goes through his head when you talk to them about death? Try it out amongst your friends and then compare it with somebody who's a believer, who believes in Allah, who believes in hereafter, who believes that his soul is to stay, his spirit has to stay. Just do the comparison and you would know that a believer is always at ease when thinking about death. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing faith in resurrection and human development. And we made a claim before the break that faith in resurrection, besides logically interpreting and revolving the puzzle of life and death, and besides being a truth which must be accepted, produces diverse effects on human life. Okay? So we are proving that how it has positive impact on human life, how talking about and thinking about and believing in resurrection improves the quality of human life in this very world. The first point, we have made it clear to you that this acknowledgement of life after death is something that gives a soothing effect to a believer and the disbelievers, those who do not believe in resurrection and the day of judgment and that eternal life. They get baffled as soon as you start the topic of death, which is an inevitable reality, by the way. Now, point number two is the realization that human thought and deeds continue to exist, that they are going through a process of development and growth, come back in a magnified form in the next world, that all good and bad deeds are to be minutely accounted for, and that one has to receive reward or punishment, as the case may be, certainly exerts a healthy effect on human conduct and behavior. Thus, the belief in the next world creates a favorable atmosphere for the promotion of good deeds and keeping the outburst of passions under a strict check. Brothers and sisters, consider a disbeliever. What incentive do you think they have in performing a good deed? Well, almost none. They are not going to live. They don't have a life after here. So they're just going to work for their own personal benefit. Isn't that right? Their scope of their actions does not go beyond their own personal benefit in this temporary world. But when you talk to a believer, when you know the believer believes that their actions are going to continue to exist, they're of course going to work towards making this world a better place to live, a less selfish place to live, and a healthy place to live. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
While the COVID-19 pandemic and corresponding economic crisis have made 2020 a devastating year for the vast majority of people throughout the United States of America, most of the country's biggest companies have prospered, only to hand a larger chunk of profits to shareholders while firing thousands of workers. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading Sick, Most Profitable U.S. Companies Fired Workers and Enriched Shareholders During Pandemic. Here's the details of this article. While the COVID-19 pandemic and corresponding economic crisis have made 2020 a devastating year for the vast majority of people throughout the United States of America, most of the country's biggest companies have prospered, only to hand a larger chunk of profits to shareholders while firing thousands of workers. An in-depth investigation published recently by the Washington Post illuminates how big businesses are having a very different year from most of the country, which is suffering as a result of the federal government's negligent response to the ongoing public health catastrophe and inadequate provision of financial assistance to working-class households. This is a global crisis, but the big companies are not treating it as one they haven't skipped a bit, said William Lazonik, an emeritus economics professor at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. The Post shared examples of surprisingly upbeat outlook shared by executives at some of America's largest corporations. I don't think we've ever been more excited or energized about our prospects, PayPal finance chief John Rainey said on a November conference call. These are times when the strong can get stronger, Nick Chief John Donahoe told analysts in September. According to the newspaper's analysis, 45 of the 50 most highly valued U.S. companies have turned a profit in 2020. Despite their financial success, 27 of those firms cut staff this year, laying off more than 100,000 workers in the midst of an intertwined health and economic emergency. Instead of using the wealth produced by workers to keep employees on payroll, corporations put Americans out of work and use their profits to increase the wealth of shareholders, the Post found. At the outset of the coronavirus crisis, the Post reported a handful of corporate executives who appeared eager to make good on a pledge made last year to focus less on shareholders and more on the well-being of their employers and broad communities, suspended payments to investors, and vowed not to hold layoffs. But then, several big firms that were profitable during the pandemic laid off workers anyway. Companies sent thousands of employees packing while sending billions of dollars to shareholders, the Post noted. Walmart, whose CEO spent the past year championing the idea that businesses should not just serve shareholders, nonetheless distributed more than $10 billion to its investors during the pandemic while laying off 1,200 corporate office employees. As Public Citizen pointed out on social media, Walmart was not alone. Pandemic layoffs included. Bea Hathaway had 13,300 workers laid off. Cisco had 8,000 workers laid off. Comcast, 3,500 workers. AT&T, 3,400 workers. Citigroup, 2,000 workers. Oracle, 1,300 workers. Walmart, 1,240 workers. And Salesforce, 1,000 workers. All of these companies have turned a profit during the pandemic. Some companies kept their promises not to lay off staff, but others cut staff even after their chief executives vowed not to do so, the Post reported. At the onset of the pandemic, Chuck Robbins described the need to keep workers employed as a moral imperative. The chief executive of Cisco, a $180 billion software and networking giant, said large companies like his shouldn't lay off workers during a global crisis because even in a bad year, they had the resources to maintain payrolls. Why would we contribute to the problem? Robbins asked in an interview with Bloomberg News published in April. To me, it's just silly for those of us who have the financial withdrawals to absorb this for us to add to the problem. 4 months later, Cisco began implementing a plan to lay off thousands of employees. The majority of Americans who lost jobs this year were laid off from small businesses, many of which had no option but to cut workers to stave off financial collapse, the Post noted. But larger companies actually laid off a greater portion of the workers over that period, 9% for large firms versus 7% for smaller firms, despite having more resources to survive the downturn. Speaking of well-heeled corporate giants, Lazonik pointed out that Apple gave back tens of billions of dollars to shareholders. It's sick, he added. According to the Post, Apple spent $41 billion buying shares and paying cash dividends between April and September, more than twice as much as the company with the next highest total, Microsoft. Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff, a signatory to the Business Roundtable 2019 statement on corporate purpose and a proponent of so-called stakeholder capitalism, is one of the executives who continued to prioritize the interests of shareholders in 2020, laying off 1,000 workers despite a 28% increase in revenue compared to last year, even after promising not to do so during the pandemic's early stages. Benioff, who the Post called the self-styled leader of the corporate philanthropy movement, in March urged his fellow CEOs to join his 90-day pledge to not lay off workers for 3 months, even encouraging Salesforce employees to keep supporting hourly workers, such as housekeepers and dog walkers who do not work for them. Making good on that pledge was not hard for Salesforce, a company sitting on more than $9 billion in cash and short-term investments, the Post added. It generated $2.7 billion in profit during the first 6 months of the pandemic as businesses flocked to Salesforce's tool for helping them manage operations remotely. Layoffs at the company occurred 5 months after Benioff pledged and were announced one day after the software giant announced its biggest quarter of profit and revenue in history, sending its stock soaring 30%, the Post reported. A Salesforce spokesperson said the company did make good on his promise not to hold layoffs within 90 days of his tweet. As the Post reported, current and former employees at some of these companies say they weren't surprised to see their leaders renege on promises to retain staff through the pandemic. They didn't put too much faith in those promises in the first place. Gary Walker, a systems engineer who was one of the 1,000 employees Salesforce laid off in late August, told the newspaper that the choices that they make are governed by essentially maximizing shareholder value. In contrast to the empty promises made by those like Benoff, Dan Price, the Seattle-based CEO of Gravity Payments, famous for cutting his annual pay by $1 million so all workers at his company could make at least $70,000 per year, seems to have figured out a way to put working people above profit margins. Price tweeted that he didn't fire anyone, instead providing small raises despite having a down year. Our company revenue is down 1% this year, the first time in 17 years we didn't grow, he said. We chose to do zero layoffs and gave small raises, crushing our profits.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
On the issue of flood and earthquake incidents and other such natural calamities, the role of the armed forces is clear. In the flood that occurred in early 1398 in the Iranian calendar, and in the earthquake that took place before that, they have really played a big role. Therefore, our armed forces are really honorable, noble, and valuable. Everyone can feel this. My dear ones, defensive power is an element of national power. If we consider at least three main elements for our national power, one of them is economic strength and stability, which is very important. Another is cultural capability and solidarity, which is fundamental. And the last is defensive power. Defensive power is vital to every country and every nation. If nations are deprived of this defensive power, then those who are after transgressing and taking advantage of nations, and who wish to interfere in their affairs and plunder their resources, today you can clearly see examples of these countries, the U.S. and other such countries, will not leave them alone.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Defensive power is absent in a country, others will not leave them alone, and they will attack all their assets. Today, you are witness to the cases of stark transgression against countries. The bases of power in the Islamic Republic are founded on reasonable bases. We do not pursue power on the basis of feelings, emotions, illusions, and the like. The bases of national power are founded on rational calculations. In other words, on correct and reasonable calculations. The size of defensive power, the width and the length of the armed forces, and the way responsibilities are divided in the armed forces, and the selection of all defensive weapons are based on correct and reasonable calculations. They are based on logic.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. Praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to
This is IRIB English Radio.